Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Good morning. I'm Andrea Bornstein, in for Brian Lehrer, and a quick correction. I said last hour that Andrew Kurtzman would be hosting a debate on Channel 2 on Wednesday at 11. It is, in fact, Sunday at 11, this Sunday. You could call John Tierney, the New York Times' newest columnist, a conservative, or you could call him a libertarian or an anti-government social liberal or just a plain old contrarian. In his columns, Tierney has written that New Yorkers and Washingtonians should pay for their own subway security. He thinks a lack of competitive spirit, not sexism, is the reason that women make less money. And he says the drug war is a total waste of time, not to mention recycling. The Rove Blaine Miller scandal, he says, is about nothing at all. With Congress on recess and the president on a five-week vacation in Texas, we thought it would be a good time to check in with the Times' resident contrarian and get his views on the national political scene. John Tierney, welcome back to WNYC.
Hi. Thanks very much, Andrea.
So let's get started with subway security. I know that a lot of our listeners are probably going to not enjoy your response to my question, but why should New York pay for its own additional security in the subways rather than the federal government?
Well, because it's a local problem. It's true that there are some places in the country that are more at risk from terrorism. But I think, in general, it's better for local people to pay for their own problems. I mean, you know, there are all kinds of different risks in this country. People in some coastal areas face dangers from hurricanes. And unfortunately, the federal government tends to pick up the tab for a lot of these things that I think would be much more effectively addressed if people paid for their own. I mean, floodplain insurance, for instance, has become this sort of great scam where rich people living in coastal homes get federally subsidized against hurricanes. And my argument with them would be that's your risk that you're living next to the water, and you should pay insurance the same way I've argued before, for instance, that New Yorkers living in apartment buildings should not be subsidizing, farmers against ice storms in upstate New York and people on Long Island who've got these vacation homes by the ocean. That basically, there are different kind of risks here, and you should pay for your own. I think that one of the risks of being a New Yorker is taking the subway. I mean, I used to take it when I lived in New York, and I take the subway in Washington, where I live now. And I think that trying to have more security on the subway is probably worth doing something, but it's essentially an impossible task. You can't.
Yeah, but okay. Well, let's talk about that in a second how to even do that. But I mean, the reason that New York is a target is because it's a sort of a symbol of the center of world finance, or at least the center of U.S. finance. That's why the World Trade Center went after it, because it was a national symbol, not because it happened to be in the city of New York. So if New York has a problem because it is a national center and a national symbol, why isn't it a matter of national defense?
Well, I would say that you're
right.
We're
not talking about subway crime here. We're not talking about thugs. We're talking about international terrorists that want to make a statement about the United States of America.
Right. Well, you're right that New York faces some risk because of it's a symbol of international finance. It also gets some benefits from that. It gets lots of tourists who come there. It gets lots of money flowing into New York from all over the world from these people investing. And I'd say, that there are benefits and costs to it, and that it's simply much more efficient for New York. I mean, we get all this money from tourists. Or you get them now. I don't live there now. But New York gets that money, and it profits in many ways from this, from being this international center. I think that's one of the costs of it. It comes with the territory.
Do you think that Homeland Security funds should be entirely locally? I mean, should this just not be something the federal government does at all?
Well, there are some things. I mean, the federal government has some kind of role in looking at the national picture and coordinating these things. And it's hard to know. I mean, I haven't sat down and analyzed exactly what it should and shouldn't do. But, I mean, simply from New Yorkers' point of view, I mean, from a purely selfish point of view, I think New Yorkers ought to be for less federal involvement, and I'll tell you why. Because New Yorkers pay much higher taxes than the rest of the country, because a middle-class New Yorker is in a higher tax bracket than someone living in the rest of the country, so he pays a higher percentage of his income in taxes. That money goes to Washington, and then it gets redistributed not to all these states that have two senators and very few people in them. And that's what's happened with the Homeland Security budget, where New Yorkers are paying a lot of taxes to Washington to the Homeland Security, and then it gets distributed not according to risk, but according to politics. And so, they're sending Homeland Security money to protect, bus stations in the Midwest. And the new head of Homeland Security has tried. I mean, he actually, to his credit, tried to say that we ought to be, spending this money where the risk is, in places like New York and Washington and Los Angeles. So
is your solution to just eliminate it entirely from the federal budget?
Well, I wouldn't eliminate it entirely, but I'm saying that I would let much more be done at the local level, because I think...
Okay, so if much more is done, you take a look at New York City's budget, there isn't a lot of money sloshing around in the coffers. Isn't that going to place even more of a strain on middle-class New Yorkers that you're talking about? If you can't get help from the federal government, you have to pay for it yourself. How is that going to happen?
What I'm saying, though, is that it's more expensive for middle-class New Yorkers to do it through Washington. I mean, when they pay taxes to New York City, at least the money gets spent there. When they pay taxes to Washington, and they pay a disproportionate share of the national tax burden, they send that money to Washington, and then most of it goes somewhere else.
There should be no federal taxes?
No, I'm not saying that, but I'm just saying that the New Yorkers, I think, have been in this sort of sucker's game. I've railed about this a lot in the past, that New Yorkers keep, looking for the federal government to solve their problems, but in fact, they're the ones who are sending money to Washington, and it doesn't come back to them.
Right, but I mean, the reality is when you say New York and Washington to pay for their own subway security, it's hard to imagine that the entire federal tax structure gets changed. I mean, what I think New Yorkers hear when they hear you say that is, you're not going to get any help from Washington, you got to come up with the money yourselves, and nothing else is going to change.
Well,
all right.
Let me tell you one example. I mean, for instance, it's always amazed me that, the senators from New Jersey and New York and Connecticut are such crusaders against cutting federal taxes. When New Yorkers, I saw one estimate that I think one round of the tax cuts, I'm not sure which one this was, that like a third of the people or a third of the benefits went to people in the New York metropolitan area because salaries are so high there.
All right. So this is Andrea Bernstein in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC. I'm talking with John Tierney, the New York Times columnist, and in a few minutes we can start taking your calls. The number is 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Has anything that John Tierney said this morning or that you've read in his columns made you think or made you mad? Or do you agree with him? Give me a call. The number is 433-WNYC. John Tierney, you noted in your column from July 9th that you were in New York on September 11th, you were in suburban Maryland during the Beltway sniper attacks, and in Baghdad. So what is your strategy for coping with the stress of living in the place that's a terror target?
I think it's trying to just keep in mind that this is really not a very high risk. Individually, that it gets a lot of attention. But, when I was in Baghdad, I was much more worried about being killed in a car accident than I was from a terrorist. I wore my seatbelt. And I was more worried about that than I was about a car bomb. I mean, and it was a risk, but... and, in fact, when I was in Baghdad, I knew people who were killed in car accidents. I didn't really know anyone... I interviewed, relatives of victims at bombing scenes and that sort of thing, but I didn't know people who were actually killed by terrorists.
Did you agree with the seatbelt legislation, libertarian that you are? Should people be required to wear seatbelts?
Nah, I don't think you need to require it, no, but, it's not one of my priorities. I mean, I guess one can make an argument that somehow there's a...
So you were actually more afraid in Baghdad of getting into a car accident, like that was actually the fear that you felt?
Completely. That was the craziest... I've spent a lot of time in third world countries where there's terrible traffic, and that was just the worst I've ever seen.
All right. Let's take some phone calls for John Tierney of the New York Times. Let's go to Bill in Brooklyn. Good morning, Bill.
Hello. I think the federal government owes us a big subsidy, New York City, a big subsidy, for providing services to immigrants to the nation as a whole. So many people settled here, schools, so many other services, hospitals. We don't get anything from the federal government for doing this. It's a service we're providing for the country as a whole, and we're not getting anything for it.
Well, the federal government does. I mean, it provides welfare payments and payments like that. But, I mean, New York benefits from these immigrants. I mean, it's a huge benefit to New York when all these hardworking people come and operate businesses and create jobs and pay taxes. And the idea that you should be somehow compensated, I mean, these are a great boost to the economy.
What do you think, though? I mean, there's an argument that, you know, having mass transit in cities like New York benefits the nation because it makes the whole country less oil dependent.
I don't think it makes much difference at all. I mean, it's nice that that happens in New York, but these are local conditions. I mean, it benefits New York to have fewer people on the roads because it's less crowded and to have mass transit, but it's something that New York ought to pay for itself. And this is something that, I mean, it's another case where New York pays all these federal taxes that then go off, and that transportation money that goes to Washington gets spent on all these light rail projects in these cities that are boondoggles. I mean, New York has the most cost-effective transit system, and I think the riders pay the highest percentage of their fare. I'm not positive, but I think that's true. But you know, but Washington just dispenses this money across the country to all these to all these suburban monorails that make no sense at all. But I mean, that's just how money gets divided in Washington. There are 50 states with two senators apiece. And the money gets divided up that way. And I remember when Hillary Clinton took office, she said that she was going to try and get together a coalition of big state senators to try and get their fair share back from Washington. Senator Moynihan always put out this annual report showing how New York got shortchanged every year, from the federal government. And Hillary Clinton said, "Well, we'll get this coalition together to try and fight for our share." And I just, there's already a coalition of people working against you. It's called the United States Senate, and it's called the Republican Party. And the math just works against New York. And to somehow think that you're going to change that and that you're going to somehow persuade all these senators from the Midwest to suddenly start showering money in New York, I mean, it's unrealistic.
All right,
even if you buy the idea that the federal government should do it.
Let's try to quickly speak to another caller before we have to break. This is Amit from Manhattan.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, you're on WNYC.
Thanks for having my call. I just wanted to respond to the whole concept of New Yorkers paying for their own subway security. Although I will often consider myself a liberal Democrat, and I do strongly believe in federal tax dollars being used in New York City for various purposes, I find that, let's say, it's really proven that New York City is going to get more security per dollar out of taxes that we would pay for security of the subway system if we channel them through the city versus channeling them through the federal government. Then our money would just be put to better use if we channel it through the city.
All right. Thank you very much, Amit, for your call. John Tierney, do you think that's ever possible, and very quickly because we do need to take a break, that New York could just get control of its own tax dollars that way, realistically?
Well, I mean, to the extent that you support more federal spending, it means higher taxes that New Yorkers will pay. And to the extent that you support tax cuts, it's more money that stays in New York.
All right. On that note, we are going to take a break. This is Andrea Bernstein in for Brian Lehrer, and we are speaking with John Tierney, the New York Times columnist. We'll speak to Mr. Tierney some more and take some more of your phone calls after this break. The number is 212-433-WNYC. It's 20 minutes after 11 o'clock. Good morning. I'm Andrea Bernstein in for Brian Lehrer, and we're continuing our conversation with John Tierney, the New York Times columnist. If you want to get in on the conversation, you can call us at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Let's change the subject slightly and talk about President Bush and the national political conversation. I've been watching with interest the coverage of Cindy Sheehan, the mom of the whose son was killed in Iraq. in Iraq and who has been camped out in Crawford, Texas. What do you think of the whole situation? Do you think that she's simply trying to grab the headlines, or is her presence there saying something about the state of the Bush presidency?
I think it's saying something about the calendar, that it's August and the press corps has nothing else to write about. She's done a brilliant job of getting publicity. She's timed it right. I think whether or not however one feels about the war in Iraq, if you're for it or against, one obviously feels for the mother of any soldier. But at the same time, I do find it for her to try and claim this sort of that her position is that gives her the right to speak out for everyone and to even speak for her son. I am struck by the fact that her son re-enlisted. That it's not as if he was tricked into doing this and then somehow realized what he got into. The fact that he did re-enlist. So,
but isn't there, there are protests and there are protests. There were anti-war protests last summer here in New York City around this time of year in advance of the Republican convention. But is the sort of reason that this mom has kind of gripped the national imagination say something about how Americans are feeling now about the Iraq war?
Well, it's well-timed in that sense. People are getting tired of the war, and I think, these things, arise to the news in part because, they appeal to that sense in people, yeah.
Until now, the president has made it his August ritual to take a long break in Texas. He did it right before September 11th, as Michael Moore reminded us very unsubtly in Fahrenheit 9/11. But I'm wondering if, the sort of this vacation, this long vacation, is once again becoming the subject for criticism, and if that vacation in itself is going to become a problem for the president.
I suppose it might. I'm struck by, the inauguration, there were a flurry of stories about how could you have the big party at a time of war. And then when you went back and looked and you saw that, well, actually the Clinton inaugurations, there were wars going on in the world, and there were some terrible things going on, and somehow, no one said that you should call off the party for that. So, there are always problems in the world, and you can always say, why is the president taking a vacation? But presidents have always taken vacations. I'm not taking one this August, but
I'm sorry for you. Let's ask. Let's take a few phone calls. 212-433-9692 is the phone number if you want to get in on the conversation with John Tierney of the New York Times. Let's go to Vic from Manhattan. Hi, Vic. You're on WNYC.
Hi. I have two questions. Number one, I was curious of Mr. Tierney's take on municipalities paying for sports stadiums and what he thinks about guest workers.
I'm very much against municipalities paying for sports stadiums, I haven't. As far as guest workers, that's a really complex topic that I haven't written about recently, and I probably shouldn't shoot my mouth off on something I know less about than other subjects.
Thanks for your call, Vic. I'm wondering, just sort of talking about this issue of sports stadiums, what do you think the tax dollars should be used for?
They should be used for things that really can't be done by the private sector, for general, for public goods, police protection, for parks, although I think, the extent that you can actually make parks private is, to support them the way Central Park is now run by the Conservancy, I think, has worked much better than it was a strictly public entity. So, it should be done for for public goods. There's a good argument to be made that you should be paying for the education of children, but it's a whole separate argument whether you should be running the schools or simply giving the people money to do that.
Let's talk a little bit about the Supreme Court nomination of John Roberts. Mr. Bush is in Texas. There's a lot going on in Washington regarding that. First of all, what do you think about Mr. Roberts? Are you in favor of his ascending to the Supreme Court?
He's going to, I think. What's really going on in Washington, I think, is a lot of sort of disappointment for everyone here was geared up for this enormous fight. And unless something unexpected happens, there's not going to be one.
Now, why is that? Is it because people like him? Is it because Democrats simply don't have the numbers to muster?
Well, it's because, you know, I mean, part of it is that he's, you know, he's a very charming guy who is part of the Washington establishment. You know, that he, a lot of journalists here, liberals and conservatives, know him. They like him. He's a smart guy. He's, and also, he, you know, he doesn't have a paper trail. I mean, he's got this enormous paper trail that people have been trying to read about his memos, but he doesn't have these decisions that people can really use against him. So, I mean, it's sad in a way that you know, the ideal Supreme Court nominee is someone who hasn't been a judge very long, because if he has, then he's written something that will offend someone. And
so, do you like him? Do you think he'll be a good Supreme Court justice?
You know, I don't know. I mean, he seems reasonable enough, and he seems intelligent, and so I guess I'm somewhat optimistic.
What did you think of the article in your paper this morning about the role of Edwin Meese in his nomination? That's a name I haven't really heard for a long time.
Well, the idea that Meese...
Certainly not on A1 of the Times.
Right. Well, I mean, Meese, is, you know, as far as his doctrine of that we should go back to the original intent of the Constitution... it doesn't sound, I mean, Roberts, I think, sounds to me as if he's, you know, he may be sympathetic to that idea, but he's also a very pragmatic lawyer who, you know, who seems that he doesn't seem like he seems more of a kind of a lawyer than an ideologue in that sense, I think, to people. And I think people think that he's probably...
Is that true, though? I mean, is he really... the impression that I came away from the article in today's paper about Meese was that, in fact, Roberts was sort of one of the founders of this movement and involved with it in the beginning, and this sort of reputation as a lawyer, not an ideologue, is not really deserved.
Well, you know, the people I've talked to who I haven't studied this carefully, but I've talked to people who do know a lot about this, and... One thing I've heard about Roberts is that he may have been, you know, in his 20s, he was, you know, during the Reagan years, that, you know, he was a very ideological and more committed, but he's done a lot of things since then. You know, he hasn't just been in the government, and he's gone into private law and defended a lot of different kind of clients, and that he's probably become a more rounded person and more rounded in his thinking and more pragmatic, I think.
You wrote recently about the Kelo ruling, about the eminent domain decision mm-hmm. by the Supreme Court. First of all, do you want to say where you stand on that, and then sort of where do you think Judge Roberts would stand?
Yeah, that's a question that I'm much more interested in than a lot of these other ones. And it's really hard to know because on the one hand, he did make this one ruling. He talked about he's shown some skepticism toward. You know, government's power to intervene in these cases, but he's also...
I'm assuming you are also skeptical about government's to do that.
I mean, I find eminent domain, I'm delighted to see that there's been a move in New York to stop it. I mean, I think that, you know, that we've been on this incredibly slippery slope where, I mean, the Constitution says clearly you can take land only for public use, and that's now been sort of defined to mean almost anything you want, that it started out saying, well, if there's a really blighted neighborhood, then we can, you know, take people's property and make it a better neighborhood. And now it doesn't even have to be a blighted neighborhood. It's simply we can take anyone's property if we have a higher use for it, and which is, of course, true for, I mean, I could, you know, think of anything better to do. I'm sure I could find a higher tax base for your home than you're being in it, so...
Based on his what you know about his opinions, where do you think Judge Roberts would stand on that? And do you think that if he got on the court, he would, you know, reverse it?
You know, it is very hard to tell that because I would suspect that his personal ideology is the government should not be taking people's property in that way, unless it's really for a public use like a highway or a park. But there's been, you know, 50 years now of court decisions that have been allowing more and more of this to happen, and so he might, you know, he might well think, well, it's become this precedent now for 50 years, and we have to respect precedent, and governments have been operating on this assumption for so long that we shouldn't come in and simply rule that it's and change the rules. Now, someone who really believes in original intent, I think, would just read that. of the Fifth Amendment and say you can't take it for unless it's for public use. So that's what they wrote and that's what they meant. But he may, you know, be enough of a pragmatist and moderate to say, well, you know, the courts have gradually allowed this to happen, and we shouldn't just suddenly change the rules.
Let's take some more callers. 212-433-9692, 212-433-9692, or WNYC, 433-WNYC. I'm Andrea Bernstein, in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC AM 820 and 93.9. My guest is John Tierney, the New York Times columnist. And let's go to George, calling from Philadelphia, PA. Hi, George.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Mr. Tierney said he doesn't know whether Mr. Casey's mother has the right to speak for him since he enlisted. And I hear this often, that because it's a volunteer army, somehow that they signed up for this. But does that preclude us from commenting on the mismanagement of the occupation from the Pentagon and the White House, that somehow because they're volunteer, we have no right to question this? I mean, the mismanagement of this occupation is horrendous. And the Pentagon and civilian parts of the Pentagon and the White House trumping people like General Psaki and the State Department on what the plan should have been for the occupation. I mean, this borders on criminal, in my opinion. And somehow, because it's a volunteer army, we're supposed to keep our mouths closed? That's outrageous.
Well, I would never say that. No, I mean, of course you're allowed to criticize it, and anyone can criticize it, including us in the Sheehan. My point is simply that to say that she has special authority because her son was killed and he was, you know, somehow that makes her position the right one on Iraq. I mean, you know, there are many people in the service and many relatives of service people who have died who feel differently about the war than she does, and it doesn't give her a special voice that she knows best about what Iraq is.
No one suggested that.
Yeah, well, no, but of course she has the right to criticize it, and so do you, and so does anyone.
I mean, theoretically, anybody could go to Crawford and protest in favor of the war also. Thanks for your call, George. Let's take a call now from Carol from Manhattan.
Yes, hi. I wanted to comment about your column the other day about choice, in which you said that even if Roe v. Wade were overturned, that it would go back to the states and women would still have the right to get abortions. But with governors like Pataki vetoing even the morning after pill, and I think another so-called liberal governor in another state was doing the same thing, it is going to be very hard to get any kind of legislation through state legislatures if it came to that. And I think you were wrong in thinking that it would be easy to maintain choice for women in most states of this country.
Well, that's a big debate. Whether, I mean, certainly that, you know, there are states you can look at different maps about. I mean, it would certainly, abortion would be legal, kind of in the blue states mostly. The red states, there's a question. There's a lot of,
there are very few states now where it's easy for women to get abortions. I mean, in many states, they still have to travel to other places to get it because there are so few hospitals willing to do it.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thanks for your call, Carol.
Thank you.
Carol from Manhattan. And let's go now to Reba, also from Manhattan. Hi, Reba.
Oh, hi. Several weeks ago, you wrote a column about the Valerie Plame case. And everyone's entitled to their opinion, but you're not entitled to misrepresent the facts. And you said that nobody cared about his mission except the Wilson family, and that she had some kind of menial position, and you sort of poo-pooed the whole thing. And that is totally ignorant, and I'm surprised that the Times would have even run that column, considering I would assume you have to have your facts right, even though you're entitled to your opinion.
John Tierney?
Well, I'm sorry that you disagreed with it. I mean, I don't know any facts I had wrong in that column.
Everything.
Well, no one has pointed out to me any facts that I know that were wrong in the column. You can certainly disagree with my interpretation, but I didn't say she had a menial position. I said that that she was not a deep undercover agent, and that, you know, she had not been overseas. And in fact, was possibly, this is still a little bit unclear, but probably not apparently not even sort of covered by this law that everyone was worried about. I wasn't trying to argue that she was menial or that it was basically, I was trying to argue that the whole way this scandal began a year ago, the most of the initial things, we thought that a felony had been committed, that this brave whistleblower who had shown that there were, who had exposed this connection in Niger had been ignored, and now he was being smeared by someone committing a felony, that those conditions didn't seem to exist anymore. That, in fact, his report, on balance, was judged to be somewhat supportive of the link. I'm kind of getting into the weeds here, but basically that he presented himself as someone who had shown that that Iraq was not getting a uranium material from Niger. And in fact, you know, when people actually read the report later, it didn't really say that, and it hadn't gone to the White House at all. I mean, it's a very complex thing. But,
all right. We're going to have to save some discussion of that for another day. I just want to ask you, in the couple of minutes we have left, you've been doing this job for a few months. Are you enjoying life as a columnist?
It's nice to be able to, you know, to have the freedom to look around and try and figure out something new to say about things. I've discovered, I knew before that an awful lot of people disagree with me, and I hear from them very vehemently.
Well, what column that you've written has generated the most response?
God, that's hard. When I wrote about legalizing drugs, it's been interesting. I got some very angry.
That was the one about crystal meth?
Well, I've written several about that, and I got very angry response from law enforcement officials and people saying, "How could you ignore the fact that crystal meth damages people?" And I mean, it certainly does. I don't deny that. But I also got an awful lot of response from people, who were skeptical of the drug war, and I've gotten an awful lot of response also from. I've written some columns about the war against painkillers and OxyContin and what that's done to patients' ability to try and get painkillers. And I wrote about a patient who's in jail now, a chronic pain patient who the DA. And I've gotten an awful lot of people writing, you know, who are angry about the Drug Enforcement Agency and this sort of war on painkillers.
So how would you say the mail runs in terms of the percentage pro and con?
Well, it depends a lot. I mean, if I write a column that, kind of the liberal, the socially liberal column side of libertarianism, then I'll get an awful lot of support.
What would you say overall? Could you give an overall number, pro and con?
More
pro than con?
It just depends so much on the column. It started out it was overwhelmingly negative, and then I've been surprised at getting some positive stuff, too.
John Tierney, columnist for The New York Times, thank you very much. You're listening to The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. I'm Andrea Bernstein. It's 20 minutes till noon.